Reconciliation, military rule, or civil war? Three possible paths for Egypt. What can or should the U.S. do? River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we'll discuss the helplessness of the U.S. in the face of the Egyptian crisis and other recent foreign policy challenges. Also on this Politics Wednesday, the move by some in the GOP to defund Obamacare. And why did Senator Ted Cruz release his birth certificate and renounce any claim to Canadian citizenship? We'll get comments on these and other political developments from this week's analysts, Stephen Schmidt and Dave Peterson of Iowa State University. Join the discussion for our Politics Day after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday has arrived, and we are so grateful to have with us a contingent from Iowa State University, two political scientists joining us from our studios in Ames, Stephen Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at ISU. Stephen, welcome back. We missed you the entire summer. I hope it was good for you.
Thank you. It was a crazy summer. Good to be back.
Dave Peterson is alongside Stephen Schmidt in Ames, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Dave Peterson, welcome to you.
Thanks.
A little bit about our battle plan for today. We'll go abroad, first of all, come back to the state, and then to go to national politics. We'll kind of weave around various things. Let's talk about the ongoing crisis, if we could, in Egypt, first of all. Today, an Egyptian court ordered that former President Hosni Mubarak be released from custody while he awaits a retrial. These are charges relating to the killing of protesters during the 2011 protests that led to the toppling of his government. Meanwhile, the Obama administration undertaking a major review of U.S. relations with Egypt concerning a decision about curtailing some of America's $1.5 billion in annual aid to Egypt. President Obama last week outlined the U.S. position on violence in Egypt, saying it was up to that country to solve its problems.
America cannot determine the future of Egypt. That's a task for the Egyptian people. We don't take sides with any particular party or political figure. I know it's tempting inside of Egypt to blame the United States or the West or some other outside actor for what's gone wrong. We've been blamed by supporters of Morsi. We've been blamed by the other side as if we are supporters of Morsi. That kind of approach will do nothing to help Egyptians achieve the future that they deserve. We want Egypt to succeed. We want a peaceful, democratic, prosperous Egypt. That's our interest. But to achieve that, the Egyptians are going to have to do the work.
In those remarks, the president said the U.S. had canceled joint military exercises with Egypt and would be evaluating further steps. River to River listeners, what do you think we should or can do in Egypt? 1-866-780-9100. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Of course, our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Stephen Schmidt, can I turn to you to have us, the president going into a little bit of the bind that the U.S. finds itself in here. Talk about that more. It sounds like a no-win situation for us at this point.
Well, the Egyptian government and military, I'm sure, are just panicked that the joint military maneuvers were canceled. You know, that's a really powerful punch. It shows you how little leverage we have. We don't really want to cut off all the military aid. In any case, the Saudis have already offered to replace that, plus add some more to it. And it is really a lose-lose situation. And that's also been true, I think, unfortunately, for all of the American initiatives in Libya, in Syria, in trying to get President Assad to quit, and now discovering that, in fact, he may be the very best thing left there because al-Qaeda and other groups, you know, are now a major player in the insurrection there. Mm-hmm. And so it's just one more domino falling in a tragic history of American policy in the Middle East, including, I would add, Iraq and Afghanistan, which in my book at least will go down in history as not very successful initiatives.
Mm-hmm. And so what is the U.S. to do here? We have to just be content to not have much influence and deal with the outcome, whether it be civil war, reconciliation, or military rule.
Yeah, you probably said it right there. I don't want to say that. I mean, the Europeans are trying to sort of push the Egyptian military a little bit. They don't have a lot of influence. You know, the Europeans are paper tigers in that regard. I guess, you know, trying to do behind the scenes, diplomatic initiatives to try to get the military to sort of back off. But it looks like they're really in no mood to negotiate with the West, and they view the Muslim Brotherhood, always have viewed them as a huge threat to the military institution. And with the release of former President Mubarak, gasoline is thrown on the fire. So I just don't see much that the U.S. can do.
Mm-hmm. Dave Peterson, anything to add to that?
No, I mean, this is part of the problem that from a foreign policy perspective that we have with democracies, right? That when you have an autocrat who has control over the entire machinery of the state, well, you got to make one person happy, and if you can do that, you can have an effective foreign policy. Democracies, the leaders now have to pay much more attention to the people within their country, and that makes it much harder for outside forces, for the United States, to have an effective foreign policy. That said, democracy is generally a good thing, and so we're in this bind of wanting to promote democracy because it's a fundamental human value that we favor, even if it's not necessarily the best possible outcome from our perspective or from our interests.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Syria, Stefan, in your comments. We have new developments there, disturbing ones, activists and rebel fighters accusing the Syrian president of killing hundreds of civilians, including women and children, in chemical weapons attacks. Video clips released on this showing children choking, vomiting, adults thrashing in agony. If confirmed, reports say it by far the worst use of poison gas during this country's civil war, claiming something like 100,000 lives so far. Again, Syria, we stand back and watch. Dave Peterson, your read on that?
Yeah, like Stefan said earlier, there's not a whole lot we can do. I mean, short of actually putting boots on the ground, which nobody wants, there's not a whole lot of options left.
Okay. Let's move to zoom into state politics. We had just this morning a report released hours ago. An independent reviewer appointed by Iowa Governor Terry Branstad, this is the former Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court, Louis Lavorato. He has concluded that the governor had nothing to do with the firing of a state law enforcement official who reported seeing the governor's vehicle speeding at least 19 miles over the speed limit. Also, no direct evidence that retaliation over the speed incident played a role in the firing of Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation Supervisor Larry Hedlund, but reviewer Lavorato could not reach a conclusion on whether his termination was justified. Lavorato writing, "I am convinced no one in the governor's office directed or interfered with the internal affairs investigation or took part in the decision to terminate Hedlund." Reaction from state senator and Democratic gubernatorial contender Jack Hatch. "The governor got the result that he asked for. No surprise here." End of quote from Jack Hatch. Dave Peterson, does this end the controversy that's been following the governor this summer?
No, I don't think it will. I mean, it's on the one hand, I can't imagine that Branstad would have, even if he wanted the outcome, I can't imagine that he would have done anything overt that would have been subject to open records requests to sort of put his thumb on the scale. That would have been so monumentally stupid that he, it just would be ridiculously dumb for him to have done that. There's no evidence that he did, and that should be of no surprise. The question is, and I think the question that the Democrats will push is, was Hedlund, nobody from the governor's office told the Department of Criminal Investigation or anybody to fire him, but did they do that with the expectation that that's what the governor would have wanted. Now, the governor didn't clearly never said that, right? But, you know, did they believe that? And beyond that, I think it's not going to continue because, you know, Branstad's done a pretty good job as governor. There's not a whole lot necessarily to campaign against him. And so I can easily envision the TV ads that whoever the Democratic nominee is going to make sort of alluding to this and about how the governor apparently believes he, you know, his time is more valuable than yours and speeding laws don't really apply to him and that he can do all this. I mean, you know, I can see an easy scenario where Democrats will make hay with this. And I think that'll be persuasive to a lot of people.
Stephen Schmidt, how do you see this story continuing?
Well, I've talked to a number of people, obviously not a quantitatively balanced and representative sample, but most of them, and actually including myself, were under the impression that under certain circumstances, the governor can drive over the speed limit with a police escort. And I don't think too many people in Iowa, you know, find this very shocking. I mean, the governor wasn't found in bed with a minor or anything like that, which would make a very good campaign issue.
But what about Dave mentioned there? People are sensitive to their leaders having an elitist view of themselves, even if that's the perception. I don't want to say that's the case, but the perception is there. Isn't that in itself damaging, regardless of this report that says there's no evidence?
People also know that powerful people, including powerful politicians, have more privileges than the rest of us do in many different ways. And frankly, I see other issues as having more substance and getting more traction for the Democrats. The situation in the Middle East.
For the governor of Iowa?
The fact that the president of China, who is a very good friend of Terry Branstad's, I guess, is launching a campaign of rejecting all Western ideas, and the Chinese government is sort of retrenching back into a hardcore Stalinist, communist kind of regime, which, you know, we thought they were sort of progressing away from. You know, that might be a criticism. There aren't very many things that Democrats can hook on the governor in terms of the economy, because unemployment in Iowa is very low. The economy is not in bad shape. And so it's going to be pretty tough, as my colleague here just said, for the Democrats to get a hook into Governor Branstad. And I'm not sure that voters are going to convincingly swing away from voting for Branstad and voting for the Democrats on an issue like this, which is at best confusing, murky, hard to understand. There's exoneration has already been issued, albeit by someone appointed by the governor, which the Democrats, I'm sure, will point out.
Okay. We'll reach out to our River to River listeners. Is this something, this controversy, this new report, is that something that has traction for you when the governor is governor's car is speeding? 1-866-780-9100. Do you care about it? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Also, in the news concerning the governor, we heard that an all-star team of national Republicans slated to help raise money for Governor Branstad. This is at a Washington event to be held September 24th. Top named special guests, including Ted Cruz. We'll talk about him in a few minutes. Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, Scott Walker, three other national Republicans signed on as sponsors. Unable, they say, to make it because of scheduling conflicts, Chris Christie, Bobby Jindal, Paul Ryan. Now, Governor Branstad has yet to formally declare a bid for his sixth term, but is aggressively raising campaign cash for the 2014 race. Dave Peterson, I don't suppose every Republican governor is able to command such attention from national GOP figures when it comes to an event to raise money.
No, I mean, obviously, anyone who is even thinking about possibly running for president or wants people to think he or she is running for president has to do this. Branstad is well-liked in this state, he hasn't really demonstrated a whole lot of an ability to have coattails or to necessarily to support, to sort of lift other candidates up. But you also don't want him mad at you, right? So, you know, it should come as a surprise to nobody that
keep your options open.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Also, on state politics, the co-chair of the Polk County Republican Party has resigned. This is quite dramatic. Changed his party registration to independent. Chad Brown is his name, of Ankeny. He's been the co-chairman since last March of the Polk County Republican Party. Resigned his position August 5th. Said the GOP has become too conservative, and is condoning, in his words, hateful rhetoric. A few quotes from his resignation letter. Chad Brown writing, quote, "I'm disappointed with the Republican Party at the national level, disappointed with the Republican Party at the state level, disappointed with the Republican Party at the countywide level. I find it increasingly difficult to defend issues and statements made by party leaders and officials from all three levels," unquote. Another quote, "It's my opinion that rather than fix the problems that led to such a massive 2012 defeat, the GOP does not seem to seriously want to fix the issues. I think helping a dysfunctional party that does not want to address its problem is enabling. I do not believe in enabling." Stephen Schmidt, what do you make of this?
There was an article about various Republicans who are feeling the heat from the Tea Party. I think Lamar Alexander was one of them, essentially pushing back. In this case, I'm not sure he's pushing back. He's just basically walked out the door. But it just underscores the division in the party, the fact that there are still some what we used to call kind of country club, more socially more moderate Republicans in the party. And many of them have already left, and either most of them just didn't change parties, but just are not enthusiastic about the Republican Party's position and vote more like independents. I'm not sure that it's a stampede of people, one person leaving the party, you know, a difference of opinion. Yes, it's a co-chair of the largest county organization in the state, with blistering criticism about the ineptness of that organization, I might add. You know, he talks about how, you know, they didn't have an office, they didn't even have a phone number, they weren't raising any money, and so on. That's never good, but I think once he sort of fades from the airwaves, the party will find someone else to replace him, and that's one less vote, maybe.
But Dave Peterson, any meaning here? How much meaning here in this resignation?
Not a whole lot. I don't know Mr. Brown, right? But he's been in this job for, what, 5 months? And the party has fundamentally changed in the last 5 months. And, you know, he also notes that he's been thinking about this for weeks. And so it's not even just in the last, you know, 5 months. It must have been somewhere in those 18 weeks that he held this job. I think he puts, you know, Sarah Palin to shame in his willingness
shortness
to step in the
term,
shortness
right.
of term on this. We see this every now and then where politicians or political officials will sort of talk about how they're not leaving the party. The party has left them. And there's usually not a whole lot to make out of it.
Okay. Let's go to our callers. I've been talking about a few state political developments. Let's go to Mary. Mary in Keokuk County. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Say, I want to disagree with Professor Schmidt in that I do believe that this little speeding incident does track among independents and Republicans. And I held great hope for Terry Branstad when he came back into office that he would have become more moderate this term and wiser. And instead, I see the opposite. And I'm totally disappointed. I'm one of those people who was raised in a mixed home, a Republican chair of my county, of my former county. My father was Republican chair. My mother was an ardent Democrat. We sisters chose our own paths. And I will tell you what, the Republican Party has changed. It's moved totally to the right ever since Pat Robertson changed, awoke the sleeping giant. And Terry Branstad is a chameleon. He has instituted an administration of fear. Anyone who is a registered Democrat who holds a political office right now or is an at-will position is running scared. He has become very vindictive. His new sheriff in town mentality has really come to the fore. He looks like an old, vindictive man, and we need better for Iowa. Thank you.
Mary, thank you for your call from Keokuk County. Let's go to Paul in Decorah. Hi, Paul. You have something on this same topic?
Similar. I guess I just want to push back a little bit and give Iowa voters a little bit more credit for their thoughts and for their vote. I think that an issue like speeding 19 miles an hour over the speed limit is a very small issue, especially when there are so many other things facing the state. And I guess I hope that Iowa voters will give more credence to things like education, healthcare issues, some of the things that Mary brought up, as opposed to a small speeding incident.
Mm-hmm. So that will not influence your vote in the coming election, 2014?
Not in the slightest.
Okay, Paul, thank you for your view from Decorah, 1-866-780-9100. Coming up to the end of this segment, I wonder if Stefan or Dave, either of you can comment on the fact that Iowa is really at the heart. It's a battleground for the future of the GOP. Dave, tell us a little bit about the factions in the GOP right now, and they're going to be visiting our state, various representatives of these factions in the coming months, Iowa being the state that it is in the political landscape.
Yeah, I mean, the Republican Party has, you know, essentially three different pieces to it, each of which is you know, none of which is a majority, but any two of which sort of can make a majority, right? There's the growing libertarian group, the folks who are most closely associated with Ron Paul. There's the Christian conservatives who have a long history, and then there's the sort of more moderate pieces of the party. And we saw this in the caucus in 2012, right? Santorum represented the Christian conservatives. Ron Paul represented the more libertarian Ron Paul type people. And Mitt Romney was the more sort of traditional piece for the party. There's a reason why those three guys finished 1, 2, and 3. And there's a reason why none of them were able to get a majority, no matter how many times they counted, of the caucus goers. This party, I think this state is seen in some ways as a battleground because of its importance in national presidential politics, and because no one of those three pieces is really dominant here, that they all have around a third of the Republican Party. And so it's not like in other parts of the country where, you know, different wings will be stronger or weaker. There's a relative balance here, which makes it a good example of the internal fight that the Republicans are facing.
Mm-hmm. Stefan Schmidt, in the minute before the break, do you see anything changing between the 2012 for the Republican Party as it pertains to Iowa and to 2016?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the caucuses will hold. I disagree with Governor Branstad, with all due respect, and I think a lot of Republicans are really angry at him for saying that we shouldn't have the Ames straw poll. I mean, that's a bigger issue than driving a little bit over the speed limit with a highway patrolled escort. And so I think we need the Ames straw poll to get the summer blues out of the system and get ready for the November season and the January caucuses. And I think we'll see something very similar from last time. Lots of candidates and lots of little splinter groups supporting each one.
Okay. Stefan Schmidt with us of Iowa State University, along with Dave Peterson, his colleague there at Iowa State University, dissecting our political landscape as of late. It's Politics Wednesday here on River to River. When we come back, we'll talk about the effort to defund Obamacare by some Republicans, how that's seen in the Republican Party, how that might play out. Also, Ted Cruz renouncing any Canadian citizenship, releasing his birth certificate. We'll talk about that. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with more River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, tune in for our conversation about science literacy in the state. Science literacy in Iowa tomorrow on River to River over the noon hour. Today, Politics Wednesday. Our guests, Dave Peterson, professor of political science at Iowa State University, also in the studio in Ames, from Iowa State University, university professor of political science, Stefan Schmidt, back from a summer break, and we're so glad to have both Dave and Stefan with us. We'd like to have you join our conversation as we discuss the latest on the political landscape. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Post message, question on our Facebook page if you like. Let's turn to national politics here in the U.S. Former U.S. Senator Jim DeMint is on tour promoting efforts to defund the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. The political arm of the Conservative Heritage Foundation, which DeMint heads, is called Heritage Action. It's sponsoring the tour. On his first stop in Arkansas, DeMint said, "It's time for the party to use its power.
This is a time to sound the alarm and tell Congress, okay, you've had enough symbolic votes to repeal it. The only real power you have is the power of the purse."
DeMint says defunding Obamacare might also mean a standoff with the White House and a partial government shutdown. He says he prefers that risk to the risk of implementing the new health care law, and those in his party who don't want to take that political risk should be replaced. Dave Peterson, how much support does DeMint have within the GOP for this, what would be a pretty drastic action?
I mean, it seems like he has just enough to fracture the party. I mean, it's he doesn't have enough to actually make this happen, right? Because remember, right, no Democrat is going to vote for that. And so they would need all the Republicans, essentially, almost all the Republicans to sort of line up behind that. And they're not going to do it. You know, the great irony is, right, is that so much of the Obamacare law was first proposed by Heritage, you know, so this is the organization that's now leading the fight to stop it.
What year about would that have been?
Oh.
So we can see how fast the evolution has taken place.
Any, right, that was in, oh, I'm trying to remember.
I can't Google fast enough.
Yeah.
Sorry.
You'd hear us typing on the keys.
That's
we're trying
right.
not to do that. But, yeah, you know, and it's also, you know, it probably should be pointed out that, you know, rather than remaining in the Senate and fighting to defund Obamacare, DeMint chose to take a golden parachute and land at the much higher paying gig leading Heritage as well. You know, this is not going to go anywhere. I mean, mm-hmm. they're going to campaign on it and they're going to, and Heritage is going to raise money on it, but it's not going to do anything.
I see reading, I've done the GOP leaders, the main ones, Mitch McConnell, John Boehner, Eric Cantor aren't on board with this. Rand Paul not on board with this. So you've got all the leaders not on board. Stefan Schmidt, if we think about the potential political repercussions of a potential government shutdown for the GOP, what would they be?
People get really angry at the national parks being closed, and the government has this incredible ability to shut down things that people don't want shut down. When Newt Gingrich was able to get the government shut down, it was a disaster. It cost the Republicans a huge amount of goodwill. It didn't last very long. It's just plain not a good strategy, either an economic strategy, because you can't shut the government down. I mean, we need the government to do almost everything that Americans value that's important to this country, national security, and people want their Medicare checks sent and their Social Security checks mailed. And you really think that the Republicans want to essentially tick off, you know, the vast majority of Americans whose necessary and actually valued programs are going to be suddenly suspended? No. Most Republican leaders think that that's not a way to go. On Obamacare, to switch to that for a minute, it barely passed. It was a horribly difficult birth for Obamacare in the first place, and now it's the law of the country. It's been implemented. Parts of it have been implemented. The parts that allow children to stay on their parents' health insurance until the age of 26 is hugely popular. There are other things that are coming online. There are many, many organizations that already are either in the midst or switching over to compliance. They are not going to support all of a sudden throwing this thing into the trash because they've already invested a lot in it and planned their business model and their long-range strategic planning around these reforms. And mm-hmm. we need to reform the healthcare system. Even Republicans, conservatives, doctors, people in the pharmaceutical industry, insurance companies, all of them agree that we need reforms, that we were not able to pass the ideal reform. Obamacare is the the lesser of the evils, which would be to pass nothing. And I think the Republicans are going to find that it just is difficult to do it. And in any case, Barack Obama is going to be president for many more years, and he isn't going to sign, you know, a repeal of it.
Mm-hmm. And pursuing this, Dave Peterson, I mean, what does this do, these continued rumblings about this and the evidential sort of the split between the GOP, do to getting work done in the House, other work?
Well, yeah, I mean, it makes it difficult. The House has done basically nothing in the last several years. And you know, I'm not convinced that there's a great opportunity cost from the 30-some votes on repealing Obamacare. It's just the nature of the institution right now that, you know, to get anything done in the House requires a majority of the majority party to support it, right? So you have to get a majority of Republicans in the House to support something. Well, to get 51% of the Republicans in the House, it needs to be something pretty conservative. The problem with that is that to get anything done in the Senate, you need 60 senators, and you also need the president to agree to it to for it to become law. And the set of the universe of policies that are approved by 51% of the House Republicans, 60 senators, and President Obama is an empty set, right? I mean, there's just not a whole lot of stuff that works. And that's not a bug in our system. That's a feature of design for the way that our government is supposed to work.
So we circle around it. Jim DeMint is a smart guy. Why do this? Why drive this wedge in his own party by pursuing this strategy?
Because Jim DeMint right now works for Heritage.
That's right.
I mean, he's no longer a Republican politician. He works for Heritage. His job is to promote Heritage Foundation, is to raise money for Heritage, and to keep them in the public sphere, right? So institutions like Heritage, part of the way that they succeed is by shaping the broader debate. And what better way to shape the broader debate than to take the lead on a position that apparently no Republican leader is willing to take, right? So he makes the Heritage Foundation look good to their donors, and it fulfills the mission of the Heritage Foundation.
1990 was when the Heritage Foundation launched this essentially health care reform idea with individual mandates in particular. And it came even before Hillary Clinton tried to launch Hillary Care. So that was the period that the Heritage Foundation thought we needed a universal mandate in order to be able to spread the funding of health care to cover people who needed health care and needed it and couldn't afford it or their costs were high by having everybody be insured. So anyway.
Before we move on, let's get a quick call on this topic. Upshare is joining us from Ames. Upshare, did I get your name, I hope, correct?
Yeah, it's Abshare.
Abshare.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to put on my little words there is that I understand when the Democrats are in power, they passed the Health Care Reform Act. And basically, what I've seen Republicans been doing for the past couple of years is trying with all these symbolic votes to get rid of the Health Care Act. I myself am not fully aware of what's in the Health Care Act. It's several thousand pages long. And a lot of us are confused. So if Republicans really have anything meaningful to say, I think they should put together a packet and say exactly this is what our health care reform looks like and let the American people decide and let us have a voice in it, but not just with all these symbolic votes and drumming up all this anti-Obama sentiment. Let's have some real facts on the table. Let's stop with all this partisan bickering, and let's have two plans to look at and basically decide which way we want to go.
Okay, thanks for weighing in there. From Ames, 40 votes, I think, to defund Obamacare held in the House. 40 of those without any outcome going further than that. I mean, let's move to a couple other things. It's 2013. Nearly 30 months perhaps before the Iowa caucuses. But let's talk about 2016 anyway. U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, the freshman senator from Texas, fueling speculation about his intention to run for the Republican nomination for president by making frequent recent trips to our state and other early nominating states. That speculation also raising questions about the senator's citizenship. Cruz was born in Canada and yesterday spoke about the circumstances of his birth.
I was born in 1970 in Calgary, Canada. My parents were working there in the oil and gas business. My mother was a U.S. citizen by birth. She was born in Wilmington, Delaware. And so under American law, I was a U.S. citizen by birth. When I was 4 years old, we moved back to Texas. We moved to Houston. I grew up in Houston, and then Houston's been my home pretty much all my life. And when I was a kid, my mom had always told me that if I wanted to, because I was born in Canada, I could act to affirmatively try to claim Canadian citizenship. But in high school, I got a U.S. passport and have lived here my whole life, have never done anything to claim citizenship, so I thought that was the end of the matter. And then the Dallas Morning News contacted some immigration lawyers, which is something I'd never done, never thought it was of consequence. And they concluded that technically I may well have had dual citizenship. And so the question was raised, actually, by a number of the men and women in this room. If I did have dual citizenship, would I be willing to renounce any Canadian citizenship? And my response was, well, if that's correct, well, then sure. And the reason is I've been an American since birth. And as a U.S. senator, I think it is appropriate that I be only American.
Okay, Senator Cruz, Ted Cruz, declining to speculate about the legal consequences of his birth. He declined to say whether the Constitution should be changed to allow those who are not natural-born citizens of the U.S. to run for president. He declined to say whether he believes his situation is similar to the questions that plagued President Obama during his presidential campaigns. Cruz, father from Cuba, he's been a strong opponent of immigration reform. Stephen Schmidt, any similarity to President Obama's situation?
Anytime someone has to have a press conference and answer questions about whether they're a U.S. citizen or not, and has a problem.
Okay.
Ted Cruz has a big problem. His problem is he's now got to actually reject his Canadian citizenship, renounce it, and so on. And I think my colleague here, Dave Peterson, has some information about what that would entail if you're interested in that. But it's a problem for him. You know, you don't want to talk about that. You want to talk about how bad Obama is and Obamacare and Benghazi, you know, and all those kinds of things. You don't want to talk about whether you are a natural-born citizen.
Let's talk a little bit about this clause about natural-born citizens, because, Dave, perhaps you can enlighten us. What does the Constitution actually say about who can and cannot be president in this context?
I mean, it's you know, I don't remember it off the top of my head, but it's the natural-born citizen line. And, right, that essentially means citizenship by birth, right? This John McCain faced this briefly because he was born on a U.S. naval base, I believe, in Panama.
Right.
And there was an actual vote in the Senate
right. Where
both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, who were running for president as Democrats, voted that, yes, he qualifies as a president. Renouncing your citizenship in Canada, by the way, is not an easy thing. I was born in 1973 in Seattle, Washington, to a Canadian mother. And Canadian citizenship law says that I actually have citizenship in both countries. It's one of those things that you're awarded by law. You don't claim it.
And you can hold dual citizenship according to both countries?
Yes. Yes. In fact, I do.
Okay. And so renouncing it will mean what for Ted Cruz?
My understanding is that he actually has to file a fair amount of paperwork in Canada to give up your citizenship. And having worked through the Canadian citizenship bureaucracy, it's kind of a pain to work through that. I worked through mine to get some identification from them. But, you know, working the other end, from what I understand, is not going to be any easier.
Mm-hmm. And he has to pay $100 to get that. And the Canadian bureaucracy is very meticulous, and he may not be able to get that done before 2016.
You don't have to fill out the forms in French as well. I can tell you that.
at least that. Will Ted Cruz face more heat on this from his own party or from the Democrats?
Oh, the Democrats aren't going to push him on that at all.
They're not going to touch it. So from within his own party, where is the heat going to come from?
No, I mean, I don't think he will. You know, it's so much of, you know, I really think so much of the concerns about Barack Obama's birth status and citizenship status was tied to the sort of otherness of Barack Obama in a variety of ways, right? I think it was tied to his race. Mm-hmm. It was tied to his international experiences as a child. It was tied to what a lot of people is a funny name, right?
Right, because there was no disputing that Barack Obama's mother is a Kansan.
Right.
Well, exactly. But if his name was Ted Hussein Cruz, he might have an even bigger problem with this. But I think it's one of those storms that, you know, lightning, some hail in it. passes by. It'll be over in Illinois soon, and it probably is not going to, be part of the incredible, highly contested race for the Iowa caucuses, New Hampshire primary, and then the nomination. But it lingers as a sort of kind of a smell in the room that you don't, it's sort of, what is this smell in the room around Ted Cruz for some Republicans? I really think that's true. His father, by the way, is Cuban, but my understanding is that he left Cuba because he supported Fidel Castro and supported the rebellion against the Batista regime at the time when he left. That could be a more interesting sort of little thing that Steve King or somebody else running for president could bring up.
Mm-hmm. And King might ask about the size of his calves, too.
And whether he's brought any cantaloupes into the United States from Canada recently, right?
Ted Cruz, as I mentioned, a strong opponent of immigration reform. Well, the proponents of comprehensive immigration reform are using this August congressional recess to urge Republicans in the U.S. House to support that Senate bill approved in June, a bill that would give millions of people who entered the country illegally a chance at citizenship while also beefing up some border security. During a conference call with reporters yesterday, a group representing labor and Latino organizations in the state of Iowa targeted its call for reform at Iowa's 3rd District Congressman Tom Latham. The president of AFSCME, Danny Homan, says Latham is more likely to compromise on immigration reform than 4th District Congressman Steve King.
We believe that Congressman Latham is probably the likely representative that would be able to work with the other side of the aisle and work to get this passed.
Okay. Dave Peterson, to you first. How likely is Tom Latham to back comprehensive immigration reform?
Well, more likely than Steve King, but that's not saying much.
Right.
I think Latham is one of the Republicans who is more moderate, who has a longer history of being working across the aisle on these sorts of policy issues, and because as far as I know, he hasn't taken a clear stance either way. He's potentially persuadable. I mean, mm-hmm. of the four, he's the one that nobody is quite sure of what he'll do. So of course, that's where the efforts are going to.
Mm-hmm. A call from Muscatine. Dave is with us from Muscatine. We're coming to the end of our show. Dave, please make it brief.
My wife and I are big fans of Stephen Schmitz. The biggest story of the summer is Steve King's cantaloupe. Stephen, please, your comments.
Well, I mean, I think Steve King has established himself as the firebrand anti-illegal immigration politician in the United States. I was on the East Coast for a while this summer. He's very well known there. You know, he's a national figure. Then he is appealing to people who are afraid of immigrants, who more than just want, some border security, really seem to sort of feel that these immigrants are a threat to jobs and the economy and so on, which has not really been established. And so he's very good at spinning things like, these young Mexicans coming across the border or others are not valedictorians. You know, many of them have ankles as big as cantaloupes because they're stuffed their socks with drugs and so on. And that has this great sex appeal for the news media because it's controversial. It's demeaning to a lot of immigrants who do come to this country, and some of them come illegally, to mostly to find jobs, frankly. I mean, there aren't very many terrorists that have been caught along the border. In fact, I saw a number the other day that they actually don't think they've caught any terrorists coming across the Mexican border. And so, King, for some reason, seems to connect on these issues in the 4th District. People don't hold it against him. Whether that will change or not, we'll see. The Democrats have missed some opportunities. The candidates running against King, frankly, have run pretty poor campaigns. And so Steve King sits on the throne of the King there because, he still connects quite well with that pretty conservative district.
Okay, Dave Peterson, we have 30 seconds left. When we look at the big picture on immigration reform, is it going anywhere, this Senate bill?
I'm hopeful that it will. I mean, it probably won't, and it really is going to depend upon whether or not the Republican leadership in the House is going to live by that majority of the majority party rule. If they are, then immigration reform is probably dead. But if they think that they need that for their party's future, then they might agree to be rolled.
Dave Peterson, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Stephen Schmidt, university professor of political science at Iowa State University. Gentlemen, thank you for coming into our studios today and to tell us about politics as of late. We appreciate both of you coming.
Yep, thanks, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Ames, we had help from Sean McClain. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Check out our podcasts, our online streaming of past shows, by going to iowapublicradio.org. Tomorrow on the program, Science Literacy in Iowa. Hope you'll tune in. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.